timely and repeated admonition in a design to injure me. He seemed to regard his land as an extension of himself, and therefore its occupation as a personal violation. The court case dragged on for 2 years, pitting the most powerful figure in the nation against a feisty delegation of impoverished farmers. Though he won the case, his victory did nothing to embellish his reputation for soaring majestically above his own private interests. The episode also exposed another anomaly produced by his insatiable hunger for land. Instead of the Jeffersonian model of independent yeoman farmers, Washington had opted for the Fairfax model of tenants and proprietary control, a choice almost calculated to slow westward migration, since no settler in his right mind would willingly opt to rent rather than own. If part of Washington's mind was haunted by memories of his landless Virginia youth, it was also stuck in the hierarchical presumptions of that same earlier era. Both his memories and presumptions were called into question in the early months of his retirement when a political firestorm broke out over his membership in the Society of the Cincinnati. Prior to their disbandment, the officers of the Continental Army had formed a fraternal order of that name and quite naturally selected Washington as the first president. While its name announced the intention to avoid meddling in politics and its constitution emphasized fraternal and philanthropic goals, the Society of the Cincinnati was an avowedly elitist enterprise designed to sustain the aristocratic ethos of superior virtue that officers in the Continental Army had been harboring since Valley Forge. Most ominously, membership was defined in hereditary terms, passing exclusively to the eldest male descendant in the next generation. Ironically, this provision meant that Washington's line would die with him, since he had no direct heirs, male or female. The society immediately became the focus of public ridicule, especially in New England, where the Massachusetts legislature condemned it as a vestige of European aristocratic decadence and a conspicuous threat to the Republican values the American Revolution had supposedly established forever. Over in Paris, Franklin lampooned the hereditary requirement by calculating that the amount of patriotic blood passed on would be infinitesimally small after 2 centuries of primogeniture. So why not reverse the hereditary principle by designating ancestors rather than descendants, preferably mothers rather than fathers, who probably were more responsible for instilling patriotism in their sons than anyone else? Washington was initially tone-deaf to these criticisms, in part because he shared the fraternal ethos of its members, whom he believed to be the virtuous few who, more than anyone else, had won American independence, in part because his own version of independence also retained an elitist edge of its own. Which is to say that he believed the American Revolution had destroyed monarchy and British imperial rule, and in that sense was a significant political revolution. But he did not believe that it was also a social revolution that destroyed the world of privilege, rank, and deference in which he had risen to prominence before the war. For him, the Society of the Cincinnati did not defy the best ideals of the American Revolution. It embodied them. Washington never changed his thinking about the Society, which he described as an innocent institution with immaculate intentions. But he did change his mind about lending his own prestige to its purposes. Jefferson was apparently the first confidant to warn him that members of the society were widely regarded as an aspiring American nobility. Its hereditary requirement, a violation of the natural equality of man, and that Washington's continued association with its agenda would do serious harm to his own reputation. In March 1784, he traveled to the first national meeting of the society in Philadelphia, convinced that he needed to resign the presidency, eliminate the hereditary principle, and, if Jefferson's recollection of a conversation in Annapolis can be believed, call for the abolition of the entire enterprise if halfway measures proved inadequate. "If we cannot convince the people that their fears are ill-founded," he explained, "we should yield to them and not suffer that which was intended for the best of purposes to produce a bad one." Accustomed to getting his way, Washington presumed that his warnings would be heeded and the society would die a speedy death. But the younger members, plus a delegation of French applicants, forced another meeting in May, in which a few minor modifications of the bylaws, which did not include eliminating the hereditary principle, were approved as sufficient to answer the public criticism. Washington attended the May meeting and released a statement designed to put the best face on the proceedings, though in private he confessed that, "We have been most amazingly embarrassed in the business that brought us here." The Society of the Cincinnati not only remained alive, the members also continued to elect Washington as president, despite his best efforts to maintain a discreet distance from their meetings. Writing from France in 1786, Jefferson reported that the society posed even greater dangers than he had previously recognized, that it was like a cancer growing in the heart of the American Republic, and that a single fiber left of this institution will provide an hereditary aristocracy which will change the form of our governments from the best to the worst in the world. The Society of the Cincinnati thus became a kind of lovable albatross tied permanently around Washington's neck. It was lovable because he felt deep emotional attachments to most of the Society's prominent members, who were the band of brothers with whom he had shared the most intense experience of his life and theirs. It was an albatross because the society became a convenient symbol of aristocratic attitudes and values, and therefore a lightning rod for the kind of conspiratorial fears that Jefferson, among others, harbored toward any institutionalized expression of social inequality. As his new aide, David Humphreys, put it in 1786, "I am sensible the subject is a very delicate one, that it will be discussed by posterity as well as by the present age, and that you have much to lose and nothing to gain by it." Looking ahead, the accusations leveled at the society provided a preview of the ideological battles destined to engulf Washington during his second term as president. Looking backward, the charges echoed the arguments directed at the Continental Army as a menacing threat to the very values the American Revolution claimed to stand for. Washington was on record as believing the latter charges were at best naive and at worst traitorous. And he confided to friends that he found the accusations against the society to be hyperbolic prejudices, conjured up by designing men to work their own purposes upon terrified imaginations. That said, his association with the Society of the Cincinnati clashed with his chief preoccupation, which was the courting of posterity's judgment. So throughout the 1780s, he chose to keep his criticism of its enemies private, and his connections with its public functions limited. Most tellingly, the outcry over the society forced him to realize, probably for the first time, that the American Revolution had released egalitarian ideas that he was at pains to understand, much less find compatible with his own version of an American Republic, which was elitist, deferential, virtuous, and honorable. In short, pretty much like him. This species of property. In December 1785, Washington received a letter calculated to focus his mind on another worrisome association, even more damaging to his abiding public image than the Society of the Cincinnati. It came from Robert Pleasance, a Virginia Quaker who had recently emancipated all 80 of his own slaves and minced no words in instructing Washington to do the same. How strange, then, it must appear to impartial thinking men to be informed that many who were warm advocates for that noble cause during the war are now sitting down in a state of ease, dissipation, and extravagance on the labor of slaves. And most especially, that thou should now withhold that inestimable blessing from any who are absolutely in thy power, and after the right of freedom is acknowledged to be the natural and unalienable right of all mankind. Pleasance, somewhat gratuitously, suggested that Washington had probably been too preoccupied with the inevitable details of his retirement routine to think about a subject so noble and interesting, because once he did think about it, his response must be as self-evident as those truths that Jefferson had enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. Pleasance did not stop there. He concluded with a little lecture, designed to strike Washington, otherwise invulnerable, in his most vulnerable spot. If he acted decisively at this propitious moment by freeing his slaves, it would crown his career and assure his place in the history books. But if he faltered and lost this opportunity, the failure would haunt his reputation forever. For notwithstanding thou art now receiving the tribute of praise from a grateful people, the time is coming when all actions shall be weighed in an equal balance and undergo an impartial explanation. How sad it would then be to read that the great hero of American independence, the destroyer of tyranny and oppression, had failed the final test by holding a number of people in absolute slavery who were by nature equally entitled to freedom as himself. Washington did not answer Pleasance's letter. He was not accustomed to being the butt of lectures, especially from strangers dripping with moral superiority, and most especially from Quakers, whose pristine consciences had obliged them to sit out the war as spectators. Nevertheless, the letter could not be summarily dismissed as a mere irritation. It linked the subject Washington cared about most, posterity's judgment, with the subject he had come to recognize as the central contradiction of the Revolutionary era. Which is to say that Pleasance was incorrect in assuming that Washington had given little thought to the question of slavery. To be sure, the subject remained the proverbial ghost at the banquet, so obviously and ominously a violation of all the Revolution stood for, that no one felt free to talk about it openly, lest the guests at the table transform the polite conversation into a shouting match. Despite the code of silence and circumspection, there is considerable evidence that slavery was very much on Washington's mind during his retirement. and the ideas swirling through his head, to the extent that we can draw them out into the open for scrutiny, followed two separate lines of thought. One line of thought was initially prompted by the exigencies of war. Washington had grudgingly accepted free blacks into the Continental Army in 1775, then had commanded a racially integrated force for nearly 8 years. Characteristically, he made no comment on this development, though it exposed him to a range of racial relationships that he had never encountered as the master of Mount Vernon. The first indication that Washington recognized the disjunction between the purported goals of the War of Independence and the continuation of slavery occurred in 1779, when John Lawrence proposed arming 3,000 slaves in South Carolina and offering emancipation in return for service to the end of the war. Though clearly a wartime scheme driven by manpower needs, the Lawrence proposal broached the possibility of making military service the opening wedge for a more general, if gradual, emancipation. Perhaps Washington was only humoring Lawrence, telling a bright young favorite what he wanted to hear, but he endorsed the idea, adding the cautionary note that a partial emancipation could backfire by rendering slavery more irksome to those who remain in it, and acknowledging that this is a subject that has never before employed much of my thoughts. When the South Carolina legislature rejected the Lawrence proposal, as Washington had predicted it would, he described the rejection as a sign that the revolutionary fires, which had burned so brightly early in the conflict, had now subsided, and every selfish passion has taken its place. Lafayette, even more than Lawrence, also prompted Washington to acknowledge that ending slavery was a logical outcome of the American Revolution. Just before the end of the war, in 1783, Lafayette urged an experiment in emancipation whereby a group of Virginia slaves would be freed and resettled as tenant farmers in some unspecified western region of the state. Washington embraced the plan without reservation. "The scheme, my dear Marquis, which you propose as a precedent to encourage the emancipation of the black people of this country from that state of bondage in which they are held, is a striking evidence of the benevolence of your heart. I shall be happy to join you in so laudable a work." Nothing came of Lafayette's proposal. And perhaps, as with Lawrence, Washington was indulging a dear friend whose visionary scheme, so symptomatic of Lafayette's romantic temperament, could be safely endorsed precisely because Washington knew that it would never happen. At any rate, Washington's public behavior at the end of the war cut in the opposite direction. In the aftermath of Yorktown, then again during the British evacuation of New York, he insisted on the return of all escaped slaves in British custody to their respective owners. Four of his own slaves were included in the contingent of about 3,000 carried from New York to freedom by the British Navy. By the start of his retirement, then, any picture of Washington's mind on the slavery question would be blurry. But there would be a picture, because he now recognized that slavery was a massive American anomaly. Before the war, the picture would have been completely blank. The picture became more focused 3 years into his retirement. Lafayette made two extended visits to Mount Vernon in 1784 and 85, and subsequent correspondence between them, as well as the commentary of other visitors, confirm that Lafayette prodded Washington to take a more outspoken position on slavery. The Virginia legislature was then debating the right of freed slaves to remain in the state, so the question of emancipation was in the political air. In April 1786, Washington wrote Robert Morris, "I can only say that there is not a man living who wishes more sincerely than I do to see a plan adopted for the abolition of slavery. But there is only one proper and effectual mode by which it can be accomplished, and that is by legislative authority. And this, as far as my suffrage will go, shall never be wanting." He wrote a similar letter to Lafayette the following month, also endorsing gradual emancipation. Then, in September, he wrote John Francis Mercer, who owed him money, saying that he could not accept slaves as payment. "I never mean, unless some particular circumstances should compel me to it, to possess another slave by purchase, it being among my first wishes to see some plan adopted by the legislature by which slavery in this country may be abolished by slow, sure, and imperceptible degrees." Whether Lafayette's affectionate prodding, Pleasance's lecturish warning, or the natural drift of his own thinking was most influential cannot be known. Whether his motives were purely moral, or mainly a fixation on his future reputation, or some seamless mixture of the two, is equally unknowable. But he was now on record, at least in private, endorsing slavery's eventual end. A second line of thought focused not on slavery as a national institution, but on slavery at Mount Vernon. During the early months of the war, Washington had presumed that his estate would become a target of British or Loyalist recriminations. By 1779, when Mount Vernon still remained miraculously intact, he began to think anew about his labor force. He told his manager, Lund Washington, that he had decided to abandon slave labor if and when the war ended favorably. If the war ended badly, all plans were meaningless. The question was not whether he should sell his slaves, he told Lund, but where and in what manner it will be best to sell. The currency inflation mitigated against an immediate sale, and his own convictions precluded any sale that split up families. But he had decided to replace slaves at Mount Vernon with hired workers. The correspondence about slavery at Mount Vernon and that with Lawrence about emancipating South Carolina slaves in return for service occurred at the same time, the winter of 1779, so it is possible that the two lines of thought crossed. But the language Washington used about slavery at Mount Vernon made no mention of moral or ideological motives. It was a hard-headed business decision, rooted in his conviction that slave labor was more inefficient and costly than free labor. And he was thinking about selling his slaves into bondage to others, not freeing them. His train of thought about slavery at Mount Vernon was apparently not driven by idealistic considerations, but by realistic calculations about profit and loss. His voluminous correspondence about the management of Mount Vernon during his wartime absence is filled with detailed instructions about which hogs to slaughter, which fields to manure and cultivate with specific kinds of wheat, where to dig irrigation ditches and plant locust trees, but says precious little about the larger contours of his thinking about the operation as a whole. In the absence of conclusive evidence, the most plausible speculation is that the decision to abandon slaves as a labor force followed logically from his earlier decision to abandon tobacco as a cash crop in favor of wheat. Once he made that decision, His Mount Vernon farms resembled the diversified farms of Pennsylvania more than the plantations of the Tidewater or Carolinas. In that altered agrarian scheme, he gradually concluded that the cost of maintaining a slave labor force became prohibitively expensive. In fact, he owned more slaves than he could productively employ, and the surplus was costing him dearly. Despite his assiduous attention to the most minute details of management, Mount Vernon made only a marginal profit in the best years before the war, and during the war it began to resemble those many Virginia plantations declining toward bankruptcy. Washington's decision to abandon slave labor, then, fit sensibly into a larger pattern of decisions driven by his acute appreciation of the bottom line and his personal obsession with economic independence. He had recognized that tobacco would not work and moved to wheat. He had recognized that the consignment system locked him into mounting debts with Carey and Company and had broken that connection. Indeed, had eventually seen fit to break with the British Empire itself. Now, he recognized that slavery was as much the source of the problem as tobacco or imperial regulations. So he needed to free himself, though not his slaves, from the costs of bondage. There was a simple but sweeping quality to Washington's grasp of the elemental realities underlying the plantation economy of Virginia, which conjured up a vision of slavery as an economic anachronism that went hand in hand with his still developing picture of slavery as a moral anachronism. Carried to its logical and imaginative limits, it was a vision of the Old Dominion as the southern outpost of a Middle Atlantic economy based on crop diversification and free labor, rather than the northern outpost of a Deep South economy based on a single cash crop and slavery. If this vision had ever been implemented, the political chemistry of the subsequent national debate over slavery would have been dramatically different, as would the inevitability of the Civil War, which is difficult to imagine with Virginia on the Union side. By the time he began his retirement, Washington's mind had not changed on this score, at least in terms of what he preferred for sensible economic reasons. But neither had the swollen size of the slave population at Mount Vernon, which now numbered slightly more than 200 men, women, and children. Given Washington's justifiable reputation for carrying through on his convictions, the question becomes, why did he not carry through on his decision to sell his slaves? The desire to do so apparently remained alive in August 1784, when William Gordon, visiting Mount Vernon to do research for his History of the War, reported a conversation between Washington and Lafayette. "You wish to get rid of all your Negroes," Gordon recalled, "and the Marquis wished that an end might be put to the slavery of all of them." A complementary set of goals that would give the finishing stroke and polish to your political characters. About this time, however, it was gradually dawning on Washington that any wholesale scheme for selling his slaves encountered three overlapping difficulties that, taken together, posed an intractable dilemma. First, the dower slaves inherited through the Custis estate did not legally belong to him, and were therefore not his to sell. Second, the eldest slaves, who had been acquired when he was developing his Mount Vernon properties in the 1760s, were now beyond their prime work years, and therefore nearly impossible to sell. Third, and most importantly, the multiple and many-layered connections by blood and marriage within the slave population at Mount Vernon virtually precluded any general sale once Washington had resolved not to break up families. By the middle of the 1780s, then, he faced what we might call a truly Faulknerian situation. Both he and his black workforce were trapped together in a network of mutual dependency that was spiraling slowly downward toward economic ruin. Hindsight permits us, the clairvoyants, to see that the only escape from this trap, the solution that Robert Pleasance urged then and modern-day moralists have echoed in our own time, was to free his slaves outright. If he gave that possibility any serious consideration in the 1780s, the idea did not make it into the historical record. It does seem plausible, though there is no evidence for it, that this was the moment when he first considered freeing his slaves in his will. The evidence that does exist suggests a more muddled position. He vowed never again to purchase another slave, a somewhat hollow promise since, as he himself acknowledged, he was already overstocked with this species of property. He accepted grudgingly the fact that Mount Vernon would never show a profit because it had become a retirement home and child care center for many of his slave residents whom he was morally obliged to care for. In 1787, he admitted that Mount Vernon had run a deficit for the past 11 years, and there was every reason to expect that trend to continue. The following year, he reported that his annual losses caused him to feel more sensibly the want of money than I have ever done at any period of my life. An English farmer, James Bloxham, whom he hired in 1786 to improve techniques of cultivation, claimed that the soil around Mount Vernon was one obstacle, but the lackadaisical workforce was the major liability. "The general have some very," here the document is illegible, "but badly manage, and he will never have them no better, for he have a set about him which I nor you would be troubled with. But the general is got them, and he must keep them. But they are a very disagreeable people." Some of the slaves, finding Bloxham equally disagreeable, threatened to poison him if he stayed at Mount Vernon. Washington himself noted that the youngest slaves were seldom assigned chores, for at present to skulk from house to house, under some frivolous pretense or another, seems to be the principal employment of most of them. The pre-war master of Mount Vernon would never have allowed such behavior. The post-war master was mellower, more willing to accept the fact that much of what he grew on his farms would never reach the marketplace, but would be consumed on the grounds by his black laborers and their families. In sum, if he could not sell them, Washington chose to make the maintenance of slave families at Mount Vernon a higher priority than profit. At some unspoken level, he saw this as a moral posture, and a small price for a troubled conscience to pay for a measure of solace. Infant Empire. In July 1784, Washington received a long letter from an anonymous admirer, which took the form of a sermon in the Jeremiad mode. It described the early days of the American Revolution as a magic moment when virtuous values flourished, patriots rallied to the cause, private interests were surrendered to public ideals, and Washington himself stepped forward to embody the self-sacrificing spirit of 76. But since those heady times, the writer lamented, the revolution had followed a precipitous downhill course, much like the corruption of the Garden of Eden after the fall. Extortioners, speculators, hucksters, and practicing lawyers had transformed the glorious cause into a degenerate exercise in profiteering and fraud. The money changers, in effect, had taken over the temple. And only the second coming of the Messiah could redeem the revolution by recovering its original character and course. There was no doubt in the writer's mind who the American Messiah was. "I am, therefore, from a conviction that the present is a critical moment for America, irresistibly impelled to address you, great sir, not only as the fittest, but I fear the only person on earth that, together with the inclination, possesses the probity and ability sufficient to avert the impending ruin." Just as he required no instruction from Robert Pleasance about the evil of slavery, Washington did not need to hear a sermon on the decline of American virtue from some anonymous stranger. He had, in fact, lived that story as commander-in-chief of the chronically undermanned, underfed, undersupplied Continental Army. But the lamentation about virtue, or the lack thereof, presumed that the answer to the problem was moral reformation, or perhaps an extensive series of frontal lobotomies. During the war, Washington had learned the hard way that depending upon a virtuous citizenry was futile, for it asked more than human nature was capable of delivering. Rather than pray for moral reform, he preferred to lobby for political reform. "No man in the United States," he told Hamilton at the end of the war, "is or can be more deeply impressed with the necessity of reform in our present Confederation than myself." Making voluntary sacrifice, the operative principle of Republican government, had proved to be a romantic delusion. Both individual citizens and sovereign states often required coercion to behave responsibly, which meant that the federal government required expanded powers of taxation and ultimate control over fiscal policy. Lacking those powers, Washington believed that the Confederation appears to me to be little more than an empty sound, and Congress a nugatory body which, in their current weak condition, could only give the vital stab to public credit and must sink into contempt in the eyes of Europe. During the initial years of his retirement, Washington made no secret of his contempt for the Confederation Congress, which he described as wretchedly managed, or his conviction that the Articles of Confederation were fatally flawed. However unexceptional these opinions might appear to us today, at the time they were distinctive. For a central impulse of the American Revolution, and the core meaning of the spirit of 76 in most minds, was an instinctive aversion to coercive political power of any sort, most especially centralized power, emanating from any distant location beyond the surveillance of the citizens it affected. These fears haunted all conversations about the proper shape of Republican government in the Revolutionary era, making the very weakness of the federal government under the Articles of Confederation the ideal expression of revolutionary intentions. In a sense, these same fears have haunted all scholarly conversations about the critical decade of the 1780s ever since, as historians have argued endlessly about the motives, whether sinister or sensible, of those demanding radical reforms of the Articles of Confederation. The terms historians have imposed on the two sides of the debates, liberals versus conservatives, Democrats versus aristocrats, have all proved anachronistic and misleading. And efforts to align the different constituencies according to wealth or discernible patterns of economic interest have also proved futile. In Washington's case, however, the reasons for regarding the Confederation government as wholly inadequate were elemental and clear, and they cast a shaft of light onto a piece of historical terrain that has sometimes been rendered darker and bloodier than necessary. Washington regarded the American Revolution as a movement to establish both American independence and American nationhood. Indeed, he did not believe you could have one without the other. Most of the officers in the Continental Army shared this view, because they had also experienced the frustrations of trying to fight and win a war without a federal government empowered to provide resources in the reliable fashion of the British ministry. The fear that haunted Washington was not one of excessive federal power reminiscent of Parliament's arbitrary and imperial policies, but rather that of a weak confederation reminiscent of the Continental Congress's woefully inadequate performance during the war. He expressed his convictions on this score to an up-and-coming Virginia statesman, James Madison, in 1785. "We are either a united people or we are not. If the former, let us in all matters of general concern act as a nation, which have national objects to promote and a national character to support. If we are not, let us no longer act a farce by pretending to it." In effect, Washington believed that America's hard-won independence would be short-lived unless the United States became a singular rather than a plural term, because a mere confederation of states would become, as he put it, the dupes of some foreign powers and, most assuredly, the contempt of all. There was one additional and quite distinctive ingredient in his thinking which had its roots in the earlier war he also knew so well. The French and Indian War was a competition among three imperial powers, Great Britain, France, and the Six Nations, for domination of North America east of the Mississippi. Washington saw the American Revolution as a continuation of that contest, in which the newly independent America displaced Britain as the dominant imperial power on the continent. "However unimportant America may be considered at present," he predicted to Lafayette, "there will assuredly come a day when this country will have some weight in the scale of empires," adding that it was already an infant empire. The strategic stakes were huge, stretching geographically across a continent and chronologically across the next century, and they could only be achieved by a federal government fully empowered to harness and manage the enormous energies and resources entailed in such a large-scale imperial project. From this perspective, to dither about the danger of consolidated political power was like arguing about a few pieces of cordwood when a boundless forest lay visibly on the horizon. While he was sure what the American future required, he was equally sure that any movement to reform the Articles of Confederation was not imminent, and if and when it occurred, he would not be around to see it, much less be the Messiah to lead it. The first indication that he might need to rethink those assurances arrived at Mount Vernon in March 1786 in the form of a letter from John Jay, who was overseeing foreign policy for the Confederation government. Jay informed him of behind-the-scenes conversations in which an opinion begins to prevail that a general convention for revising the Articles of Confederation would be expedient. Jay acknowledged that we are in a delicate situation, and a premature effort at reform that failed would be worse than no effort at all. But if events did move in that direction, Jay observed, I am persuaded you cannot view them with the eye of an unconcerned spectator. Washington concurred that the situation was indeed delicate, but doubted that the time was ripe for a convention. The fiscal problems needed to fester and deepen. Some unforeseeable crisis needed to galvanize public opinion in favor of reform. As for his own role, having happily assisted in bringing the ship into port, and having been fairly discharged, it is not my business to embark again on a sea of troubles. And so, on this dismissive note, began a year-long negotiation that eventually ended with Washington attending, and of course chairing, the Constitutional Convention, then becoming the inevitable and unanimous selection as the first President of the United States. But what has the look, at least in retrospect, of a foregone conclusion, happened in a genuinely grudging and truly tortured fashion. A cynic might be tempted to argue that Washington played the role of an elusive coquette, rejecting all suitors while knowing full well that she is headed for the altar. The cynic would be wrong, however, because Washington's personal correspondence reveals a thoroughly retired hero who felt less like a young coquette than an old soldier past his prime. He was also the American Cincinnatus, who relished his retirement as the final testament to his heroic status, the immortal whose fame derived more from his surrender than his exercise of power. What we see clearly as a glorious capstone to his career appeared initially to Washington more like a highly problematic sequel. Almost on cue, the galvanizing crisis that he had half hoped for occurred in western Massachusetts. In the fall of 1786, Daniel Shays, a veteran of Bunker Hill and Saratoga, mobilized 2,000 indebted farmers to protest mortgage foreclosures and higher taxes by threatening to capture the federal armory at Springfield in western Massachusetts. Initial reports to Washington of what was called Shays's Rebellion were hyperbolic and alarmist, describing a body of 12 or 15,000 desperate and unprincipled men about to transform all New England into a bloodbath. Actually, the most alarming feature of the Little Rebellion, as Jefferson called it, was the set of principles the rebels declared, which were eerily similar to the revolutionary principles of 1776, thereby suggesting that the grievances hurled at British rulers could also be used to undermine elected officials in Massachusetts and beyond. Eventually, Washington received more detached assessments of the uprising from Benjamin Lincoln, a former colleague in the Continental Army who led the Massachusetts militia units that suppressed the rebellion. Nevertheless, Washington insisted on seeing the crisis as the harbinger of prospective anarchy, which seemed to confirm what British and other European observers had been predicting all along, that the infant American Republic was destined to die in the cradle. "The picture which you have drawn and the accounts which are published of the commotions in the eastern states are equally to be lamented and deprecated. They exhibit a melancholy proof of what our transatlantic foes have predicted, and of another thing, perhaps, which is still more to be regretted, and is yet more accountable, that mankind, left to themselves, are unfit for their own government. I am mortified beyond expression whenever I view the clouds which have spread over the brightest morn that ever dawned upon my country. For it is hardly to be imagined that the great body of the people can be so enveloped in darkness or short-sighted as not to see the rays of distant sun through all this mist of intoxication and folly." Shays's rebellion was less a cause for calling the Constitutional Convention than a trigger. The justification to implement those behind-the-scenes conversations that Jay had described to Washington the previous spring. As those conversations developed in the form of plans to gather state delegations in Philadelphia in May 1787, arguments formed in his mind that allowed him to resist the mounting pressure to lead the Virginia delegation. Up until the last possible minute, Washington performed a political minuet that let him dance away from all invitations and overtures to resume his public career. The first line of defense was the Society of the Cincinnati. In keeping with his decision to maintain a discreet distance from the aristocratic aura surrounding the Society, Washington had declined the invitation to attend the annual meeting, which just happened to be scheduled for Philadelphia in May. He could not possibly attend a political convention at the same time and place without giving offense to the former officers of the Continental Army, he explained, though the Virginia delegation had his heartfelt support. The second line of defense was that very Virginia delegation, for he had noted that the list of delegates did not include his name. This was a rather lame and hollow excuse, since Washington had not been elected to the delegation only because the Virginia legislature had presumed that he would decline to serve. Once he tried this line of defense, Edmund Randolph used his power as governor to breach it by requesting and receiving a unanimous vote from the legislature on behalf of the one man who began, carried on, and consummated the Revolution. Though tactically outmaneuvered on this front, Washington insisted that the endorsement by the Virginia legislature, while edifying, made no difference since rheumatism and a host of other ailments made a trip to Philadelphia impossible. One senses that these official excuses were convenient covers for deeper reasons that could not be aired so publicly and that lay within him in two overlapping pools of reticence. The first was the conviction that once he had assumed the role of American Cincinnatus, he could not change the script. In 1783, he had promised to leave public life forever. So, attending the Constitutional Convention would, as he put it to a friend, be considered as inconsistent with my public declaration delivered in a solemn manner at an interesting era of my life, never more to meddle in public matters. This was a declaration that not only stands in the files of Congress, but is, I believe, registered in almost all the gazettes and magazines that are published. Cincinnatus, in effect, could never come back. A second private reservation flowed directly out of the first, though in a slightly more strategic direction. Namely, he could not risk his reputation in a venture that might not succeed. Henry Knox, his old wartime colleague, warned him that the different state delegations were likely to be divided into three factions. Moderates, who wished only modest changes in the articles, conservatives, who wished no change at all, and radicals, who wished a major transformation and an energetic national government. Only if one could be assured that the latter group would triumph was the gamble of Washington's prestige worth the risk. Knox preferred military metaphors, comparing the decision to attend the convention to the decision to engage the enemy in battle, which should only occur when the outcome was likely and conclusive. Washington observed that the current government was more like a house on fire. If one could be assured the delegates intended to extinguish the blaze, he could join the effort. But if not, perhaps the best course was to let the house burn down and hope that others would build a new one later. Why risk his reputation, especially when gliding down the stream of life in tranquil retirement is so much the wish of my soul that nothing on this side of Elysium can be placed in competition with it? But the reputation argument, the more Washington thought about it, was double-edged. On the one hand, his singular status, what he referred to as the peculiar circumstances of my case, cut toward caution, since his legacy as America's greatest revolutionary hero was already secure. So investing this priceless asset in an uncertain cause appeared imprudent. On the other hand, suppose the convention succeeded in producing a viable political framework that secured the revolution. Knox acknowledged that such an outcome would also secure the Washington legacy, which would be diminished if, in his terms, the House was permitted to burn down. But were an energetic and judicious system to be proposed with your signature, it would be a circumstance highly honorable to your fame in the judgment of the present and future ages, and doubly entitle you to the glorious Republican epithet, the father of your country. Washington had already begun to gauge the consequences for his reputation if he stayed away from Philadelphia, wondering whether my non-attendance in this convention will not be considered as a dereliction to republicanism, nay, more, whether other motives may not, however injuriously, be ascribed to me for not exerting myself on this occasion in support of it. These crisscrossing thoughts began to move in a discernibly positive direction in mid-March 1787, largely as a result of Madison's influence. No one was more adept than the precocious Madison at assessing the nettlesome details that spelled the difference between success and failure in a political contest. He informed Washington that his canvass of the roster of state delegations revealed an impressive array of talent heavily weighted in favor of much more than tinkering, indeed disposed to a thorough transformation of the existent political system. This piece of intelligence tipped the balance. Though he retained his reservations about again appearing on a public theater after a public declaration to the contrary, and though he cringed at the realization that his participation in the convention will have a tendency to sweep me back into the tide of public affairs, Madison's report altered his sense of the odds. Once convinced that the convention would address the fundamental problem, that it would adopt no temporizing expedient, but probe the defects of the Constitution to the bottom and provide radical cures, whether they are agreed to or not, Washington decided to cast his lot and his reputation with Madison and the Virginia delegation. Once on board, an informal council of advisers quickly formed around him that included some of the sharpest political minds in the country. For his part, Washington knew what he knew, essentially that the articles must be replaced rather than revised, and that the new government needed to possess expanded powers sufficient to make laws for the nation as a whole. Beyond that, more specifically, what the shape of the political architecture constructed on the new foundation might look like, he acknowledged his need for education. Since it was a foregone conclusion that he would be chosen to preside over the convention, Jay and Madison volunteered their services to give him a tutorial in Republican theory. Washington was accustomed to leading by listening. During the Revolution, he had chaired countless councils of war in which junior officers presented options to the commander-in-chief. Before the war, George Mason had helped him understand the constitutional arguments against parliamentary taxation. In 1787, as in these previous instances, he already possessed a firm grasp of the elemental forces at work and a clear set of convictions about the strategic direction in which to lead those forces. Where he needed assistance, and he was completely comfortable requesting and receiving it, was in mastering the theoretical vocabulary that more formally educated colleagues possessed, learning the intellectual roadmap to reach the destination he had already decided upon. In a remarkably prescient letter, Jay described the preferred conclusion in Philadelphia as a federal government comprised of three separate branches, executive, legislative, and judicial. The executive branch should stop short of monarchy, but only slightly. The national government should have a veto over all state laws, much like the British King's veto over colonial legislation. The knotty question of sovereignty, did it reside in the states or the federal government, might be ingeniously resolved by locating it in the fountainhead of all authority, the people. Madison was equally thoughtful in anticipating the major controversies likely to dominate the debates in Philadelphia. He predicted that the big fight would center on the question of representation in the legislative, whether by state or population. If the former option prevailed, it meant that the new Constitution would fail, since only a Congress that accurately reflected the population as a whole could claim to be a national institution. Like Jay, Madison also wanted a federal veto over state laws. And on the sovereignty problem, he had begun to entertain an unprecedented solution, which was to dispense with the assumption that sovereignty must be clear and indivisible. "I have sought for some middle ground which may at once support a due supremacy of the national authority and not exclude the local authorities whenever they can be subordinately useful." Here was the core principle of what became federalism: mutual and shared sovereignty between the state and federal